Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you're enjoying your lunch. I almost forgot to introduce today's session. I was learning so much from Professor Westad up here that I was caught up in empire in China and Southeast Asia. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters and the Board of Governors here at the FCC. Thanks very much for joining us today. Quick housekeeping note, please do remember to switch off your mobile phones if you haven't done so already. And just a quick reminder of our upcoming events at the FCC. We've had a glittering array of academics and authors recently. Our next speaker will be Christopher Dillon, who has written a pretty much a how-to book on buying a home in China, Who, What, and How. And that is happening on the 24th of this month. Now on to the event of today, Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. I think many people are thinking about how China views empire with the North Korea issue continuing to rattle north of us at the moment in Asia. And Professor Westad with the LSE is here visiting Hong Kong. I'm pleased to say he will be in Hong Kong two times a year at Hong Kong University. He also makes the rounds at Beijing University as part of his research and teaching. The way he describes his interest to me is history and how it works and melds into the contemporary world. He is the author of no less than 15 books. Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750 has been out since September in the United States, and already he's at work on his next book on international history of the 20th century. My pleasure to introduce Professor Westad.
Thank you very much, Tara. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been to this august building once before, but as a guest, so this is my first time to be here as a speaker, and it's something I have really been looking forward to. Let me also thank my hosts here in Hong Kong, Hong Kong University. I'm going to be visiting with them a couple of times per year for the next 5 years or so, and I also want to extend a special thanks to the LSE alumni group in Hong Kong, who've been tremendously efficient and tremendously kind in setting up a number of meetings for me. And Kenneth Lai, who is here today as my guest, I thank you and your colleagues. Now, this book that Tara referred to is a book that I've always wanted to write. Ever since I came to China the first time as an undergraduate exchange student at Beida at Peking University back in 1979. So I have been going in and out of China for quite a long while. I'm not a sinologist. I'm an historian with an interest in contemporary affairs who happen to read and speak Chinese. I work on other topics besides China and this region. But the reason why I wanted to do this particular book is that now is really the first time that it's possible to do a China-centered history of Chinese foreign affairs, because so much in terms of sources, so much in terms of materials are now available that we could only dream about a few years ago. You could actually now do different kinds of archival research in China with some difficulty because of censorship and attempts at moving away from source-based historical research there, but you can still do it. I think it's important to underline that. I mean, you can do it to a degree that you couldn't do it before. This book wouldn't have been possible to write the way I've written it 10 years ago. Entirely impossible. Now, any book of this sort, I think, has to start with a discussion of definitions of various sorts. You have to think a little bit, as I've been doing with my involvement with China now for a very long time, really about what China is. And it's very hard, when you worked on China for a long time, to come up with a clear definition of that. With some countries, it's reasonably easy to do it. With China, it's difficult. And part of the reason, of course, has to do with China being a very big country, but it also has to do with its deeper history and with its cultural background. So here's my working definition for this book, for what it's worth. China, to me, is a culture, a state, and a geographical core, around which identities and boundaries and definitions of purpose have shifted and adjusted for a very, very long time. And it's that shifting and adjustment that I'm particularly preoccupied with in this book. My students very often ask me when I'm working on a project, so, Professor Westad, what is your argument with regard to this book? And that's, of course, because I push them all the time to say, well, what is your argument in this essay? What do you really want to say? Now, in this one, of course, I have to disappoint them, because in a book of this sort, there isn't really just one argument, but there is an approach. There is a sort of point of view, a place of view, rather. And that has to do with China's changeability, the metamorphosis that modern China has gone through and today's China has come out of. This is a book about change, about tremendous change on a scale that the world has never really witnessed before in any meaningful sense. It is about hybridity. It is about how contemporary China has been created from many different backgrounds, some domestic and some foreign, with the China that we see today being a hybrid of the two. Now, very often, because none of the people here would fall into this trap, because you people who have worked on China as journalists, and may I say, this is not just pandering to my audience, very few people I've learned more from in writing this book than several generations of journalists who worked on China. You will know a bit about this, but very often the impression that people present abroad is of the lack of change in China. I mean, if you think of it for a broad period of time, a long period of time. A French historian called his book on China The Immobile Empire. Well, my empire is a restless empire. And it goes back to the 1750s when this book starts. China is a society or a set of societies that for various reasons, most of them in my view historical, is particularly well suited for embracing change in a way that many other countries are not. The comparison that I make in the book, which quite a few reviewers pick up on, is of course with the United States. And I see many more similarities, particularly in the 20th century, between US and Chinese societies than what most people pick up on. Countries in which you can easily reinvent yourself, you can reinvent your background, your families, your positions, your points of view, your beliefs, even your name, if you like to, in order to fit into an ever-changing world. As a rather old-fashioned European myself, I sometimes find the speed of change quite mind-boggling. But it is where the emphasis needs to be put, I think, with regard to contemporary China. Now, I also try to deal in the book with some issues that come out of China's deeper past. I mean, you have to do that. There has to be some issues, some degree of constancy in terms of debates on the Chinese side, as there is everywhere else. The three that I like to present, there are many of these, of course, but three I like to present on, really do go quite far back in Chinese history. Let me just spend a little bit of time talking about these, and then reflect a little bit on how these influence a couple of issues that we're dealing with in today's Chinese foreign affairs, where I want to put most of the emphasis in this talk so we can have a good discussion afterwards. The first of these concepts and perceptions carried over from the past is a set of concepts of justice. Justice in terms of international affairs, about China's position in international affairs. This is not distributive justice of the kind we often think about in Europe or in North America. It is about position. It is about sovereignty. It is, of course, also fundamentally about a sense that China has been treated very unfairly by foreign countries for a very long period of time. Now, as I argue in the book, because if you look at China's own relationship to its immediate world, concepts of justice can easily be turned around in terms of how China itself behaves. But that's neither here nor there in terms of this general argument. This is a China-centered history, as I put it, and for the Chinese who carry out today's foreign policy, looking back. This idea that China has been treated very unjustly, but also the concept that international affairs need to be based on some ideas about justice. It's very, very widely held. It goes back, at least in its current form, to the 19th century, when China was trying to embrace concepts of international law as it was established abroad, and then found, to that first generation's horror, that international law was something that looked very nice on paper, but very few Western great powers actually lived up to the commitments that they'd taken on in international law. That sense, I think, is still there with regard to the carrying out of China's foreign policy. The second long-term set of concepts that I'm dealing with is in the book, have to do with rules and rituals. And again, you have to be careful. I mean, this is not the kowtowing of the 18th century, people who are trying to send embassies, delegations to the imperial court at Beijing and are kicked out because they can't do the kowtowing, you know, in the right manner. That's not what this is about. It is about a set of rules, going back to what I've already said about concepts of justice, whereby it would be easier to carry out a form of Chinese foreign policy that could be planned long term. I think with the current leadership, the leadership that's just come into power now, this is particularly striking. Many of them are looking for a world that is better ordered, where they are very risk adverse. They want to move away from a situation in which things are unpredictable. And China's preoccupation long term, some of this is confusion, as many of you will know, but it's not just about Confucianism, with rules and rituals do connect very much up to this sense of organization. Think about China's behavior at the UN, for instance, of late. In foreign policy terms, many of us would argue reasonably counterproductive. Think about Libya and Syria. But still very much connected up to this general sense of a set of functioning rules and rituals. And then finally, there is the concept of China's sense of centrality. Again, you have to be careful with this. I mean, as many of you will know, the Chinese name for China, Zhongguo, doesn't really mean that China should, it's not a slogan, China should not forever be the center of the world. It's an historical concept that comes out of a group of states that existed more than 2,500 years ago. But in terms of its own region, the concept of centrality still works in terms of China's size, but much more importantly to me when I've written this book, in terms of culture. The idea very deeply held among most Chinese that China is the root bun of all Confucian culture that's been spreading in terms of language, in terms of script, in terms of ideas, the spread within the wider region still plays a very important role in China. It can be used for good, and it can also be used in order to stoke conflict because of the insistence on China's centrality. Now, there's much more in the book than this, of course. It's a book of more than 500 pages, where I try to link China's past to its presence in terms of international affairs. But I just wanted to pause on these concepts in order to give you an introduction, first and foremost, to how my thinking goes with regard to the book, what kind of concepts I'm preoccupied with. Let me then turn, in the minutes I've left, to try to deal with the concepts of the past and the way they work on two particular aspects of contemporary China foreign affairs, I mean the issues that we are dealing with now, the Korean Peninsula and Southeast Asia. I believe very firmly, as I say in the book, that what we are watching at the moment is not China becoming a global great power. That will take a very, very long time indeed. We are looking at a process whereby China's leaders want to make their country into the key power within its own wider region. And that's what we will be witnessing over the next half generation or so. There is nothing unavoidable in this. There is nothing predetermined in this. China has many domestic weaknesses within the country itself that could point in a very different direction than China's irresistible rise, even in a regional context. But this is where the emphasis is in terms of the new leadership that has come into power now. Now, of course, if you look at the situation within this region, many of you will know this better than me, even that concept of centrality is a very, very hard sell. China has one formal ally in the whole world, and that's a decrepit dictatorship on its border in Korea, North Korea, on which has become very obvious recently. China has a great strategic investment, but relatively limited influence. Now, I think the last 48 hours or so have shown us some of this. I mean, I think this has been underway for quite a while. It was underway even when Hu Jintao was in power. The concept within Beijing, and as Tara and I were talking about over lunch, very often coming from people I would regard as nationalists on the Beijing side, that North Korea could be more of a problem than what it's worth. You know, when you have one ally in the world, you want to be the regional great power, possibly a global great power in the next generation. And you have an ally like North Korea, and you don't really have an ally, you have a problem. I mean, you have a very, very big problem on your hands. And many of the more nationalist-oriented foreign policy advisors, top people, particularly within the party, the small leading group of foreign affairs, the staffers, people who work for the Central Party School, where I speak quite regularly, or people who work in the international department of the party, there has been a change with regard to this, where North Korea now is seen more as a problem than as an asset. The question is, of course, what to do about it. And on that, I don't think there are many good solutions in Beijing, as indeed there aren't many good solutions elsewhere. There's a clear understanding, I think, among the people I'm talking about here in Beijing, that things have taken a turn for the worse. The underlining that I find now of a dissonance between what North Korea is doing and what China's broader strategic interests are is very striking. But what has really, really changed to me is this. And this almost reminds me of American foreign policy a generation ago. It's what you could call the domino effect, that some of these people have started thinking, if our only ally can treat us in this way, what kind of effect will this have elsewhere? I mean, why on earth should countries in Southeast Asia respect us in terms of what we want to achieve when we can't even handle our younger brother in Pyongyang? Now, our much younger brother, of course, with the latest Kim, who come into the succession. So things are changing, and they're changing, I think, quite rapidly with regard to perceptions in Beijing on this. We can talk more about this later. Let me turn to Southeast Asia, which to me very much is the biggest problem area in terms of negative change on China's foreign policy that I've observed over the last 2 years or so. Deng Xiaoping always said that his greatest achievement in terms of foreign policy was not normalization, full normalization with the United States, or the ability to work with the Japanese. Look back at what the relationship was like back then. Now, it was the breakthrough with regard to Southeast Asia, to take a generation or more of enmity and suspicion and turn it into a beginning degree of cooperation, not least in economic terms. Now, the last leadership managed to wreck most of that by its insistence on China's rights in the South China Sea within a time period that's probably less than 2 years. And this is a hole that China needs to get out of. I think there are some people within the new leadership who realize this, who realize that centrality can be about cooperation as much as the insistence on China's rights, which of course they would get no support for in an international setting. But I'm also worried in terms of the lack of knowledge on the Chinese side with regard to this. I mean, I met quite a number of reasonably mid-ranking diplomats in the Weijiaobu, in the Chinese Foreign Ministry, who do not actually understand that the so-called nine-stipled line isn't even a Chinese demand. I mean, you know, it's a way of underlining some unclear kind of historical claims that are there, but they do not understand that under international law, even the maximum international law that they could get support for, China would have no chance of claiming this as Chinese territory. The most they could ask for and they admit this if you push them, is of course the 12 nautical mile zone around islands, islets, shoals, reefs, whatever, that could be deemed to be Chinese territory. And the South China Sea looks very different then than what it looks like if you take a pale shade of red and spread it all over the South China Sea within the non-stipal line. So this is a classic case, I think, of an emerging power shooting itself in the foot by what Paul Kennedy, half a generation ago now, called imperial overstretch. You think that things are going so well for you that you could emphasize your maximum demands, and then you're very quickly brought down to earth because you do not have the capability of following up on this, and the result is that you alienate a very large number of countries, many of which are rising powers in their own right, with a young generation that is at least as nationalist as young people tend to be in China. I think there are smart people in Beijing now, including at least a couple of people I know working with Xi Jinping, or at least worked with him before he took over, who realize this. It will be a test, I think, based on this pause that I've spoken about, in terms of how China will be able to further emphasize change in a positive sense, in terms of its own rise within the region, whether it is able to turn around from a policy that will set it at odds, possibly for a generation to come, with the main Southeast Asian nations, and find back to an emphasis on economic cooperation and other forms of infrastructural developments that the leadership of 25 years ago tended to underline. So that's what I wanted to say this afternoon. Very grateful that so many of you could come to listen to me. I'm looking forward to our discussion on these matters. The book is on sale around the corner in case you wanted to pick up a copy. And I'm even told that I will have time to sign it afterwards. Thank you very much.
I guess instead of carrying around a little red book, you get to carry around a very big red book. So we have plenty of time for questions and answers and discussion. Let's start over here. Please give us your name and an organization if you're with one. Microphone over in this direction. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Edith Terry, former journalist. I'm very interested in how, in whether the people you're talking to in Beijing have any idea, any sense, of any recognition that the shift in Myanmar towards the U.S. and away from China is their fault. I find your interpretation quite fascinating, but whether it's getting through or not is my question.
I think the answer to that, does this work? Yeah. Straightforward answer is yes. I mean, there are people who realize that. Now, that said, I think they realize it in exactly the fashion that you put it, that this is about the United States, which I'm not so sure it actually is. I mean, Tara and I were discussing this earlier on. I think what the United States has done with regard to Burma is that it has piggybacked on ASEAN initiatives that started much earlier, in part as a result of the deteriorating relationship between the bigger countries within ASEAN and China. And it was very clear right at the beginning of the difficulties that started to develop with regard to the South China Sea and some other matters, it should be said as well, between China and ASEAN, that infamous Hanoi meeting now almost 2 years ago, that Burma was going to be one of the areas in which ASEAN could strike back, and they certainly did. I mean, one of the most fascinating examples of what ASEAN has been able to do has been with regard to Burma. The concept of, which existed within ASEAN for a very long time, that you know the Burmese junta could have its way and then things would sort themselves out in their own good time, a rather classical ASEAN approach for many issues, it must be said, fell away at the point when it was clear that China wanted to challenge ASEAN on other interests with regard to the region. And there was more than a subtle shift in ASEAN policy towards the Burmese at that point. The United States were able to build on that, came in later. Of course, that had a major effect and was incredibly important. But this shows the weakness. I mean, it's a very good issue to show the weakness of China's foreign policy within the region, at least over the last 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Bob Ness. I'm from the British Council here in Hong Kong. I have a question about so-called soft power. And you were talking about culture, you're talking about China's role, not just in the world, but in the region. Just been talking about that. And there is a thesis that China suffers, if that's the word, from a very significant deficit in soft power. Do you agree with that? And if you do, what do you think, is China aware of that? And what's China trying to do about it?
That's a good question. We at LSE Ideas, which is the center that I run at LSE, trying to link historians and international affairs experts and sociologists and anthropologists and lawyers and even a few others together to think about the impact on the of the past on the present. We also run a training program for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, for Wai Jiao Bu, which really came out of Jiang Jiechi being an LSE graduate, the now former foreign minister, the state councillor on dealing with foreign affairs. So one of the first people we had with us, they have to do a dissertation, and he already served as ambassador a couple of places in Africa, and he was going to do China's soft power. So he started out working on this, and after a couple of months he came to me and said, I can't do this. I said, why not? And he said, China doesn't have any soft power. He just absolutely none. How on earth can I write about China's soft power? And he was right, more or less. I mean, there are some cultural resonances within this region of China being that originator, that root of a common culture. But if you look at the way China is governed now, and I think the main conclusion is in many fields very badly, this is certainly not what other countries want to emulate. In terms of culture, when you think about young people and where they get their music or the films and the cartoons from, there might be some from China, but not very much. If you compare, in that respect, China's soft power to South Korea's soft power, you know, it's a major difference. I mean, the problem is that it's very hard to develop soft power within a society and state that many others will not find very attractive. I mean, that is the problem. I mean, the question is, would you really want, all other things being equal, to go and live in China if you had your pick elsewhere, and it wasn't just about the money? You know, not many people in this region would answer that in the positive. So this is a problem. One should be careful in the kind of international constellation that exists within Eastern Asia now to exaggerate the significance of soft power. I don't think China's biggest problem in terms of its international affairs within the region now is its lack of soft power, but it certainly doesn't help.
Philip Bowring, journalist. I had pleasure of reading this of your book on Kindle a few months ago. And the main point that I was left with, and I know it wasn't your main point, but it was the main point that sort of occurred to me, was that as one who's sort of listened so much to Chinese accounts of humiliation, which are all true, it's the expansion of the Chinese empire over the last 250, 300 years.
Sure.
Taiwan, Manchuria, Xinjiang, Tibet, right. Taiwan, and driven not just by Beijing, but by demographics, including the demographic movement into Southeast Asia. Now, we're not talking about power for the moment, but we can talk about demographics.
Sure.
And demographics has gone into reverse. Now, what's that going to do to the greater China that we've seen expanding over the last 250 years?
Well, let me start with the last part of your question. That if it doesn't turn around rather quickly, it will be an absolute disaster. And a man-made disaster, one in a long row, of course, that have befallen the Chinese people over the past three generations. The end result of today's population policy is that China will be old before it's rich. And it will be the first major country ever that will happen to. And it will be a major problem. I mean, particularly since many of China's competitors have very healthy rates of population replenishment, which I think is probably right for countries that are at their overall level of development, if you think about it historically. While China will end up in a position with a very rapidly falling population, just at the time when China will need younger people the most, to look after both its economy and an increasing number of elderly people who will live longer and longer across the country. This is one of the many things that the current government has not got right. And problem with demographics, as you know, or population, is that it takes a very long time to rectify this. I mean, even if China went away from the one-child policy and introduced, say, a three-child policy now, which I think would be a very good idea, it would still take another generation and a half before that actually comes into being in a sort of broader economic sense. So these are very serious issues. The other part of your question is also important to underline, and that goes to this definition of what China is. I mean, and it is one of my attempts at getting away from the concept of Chinese inward-lookingness, you know, if you go back to the 18th century. That's why I started this book in the 1750s, with the Qing dynasty being at its peak, being an ever-expanding empire that no one wanted to get into trouble with, regionally or otherwise. And of course the dynasty that gave China its present shape. I mean, this is part of the problem for today's government in Beijing. It's an empire that is trying to behave as if it were a nation state. And that's very difficult, at least if you're not willing to go into a very large number of compromises with other peoples, non-Chinese peoples who live within your borders. I think this will be one of the major challenges for any Chinese government in the future, is to try to reinvent that relationship in order to avoid significant problems at the country's edges.
Over here, and we'll move around in a circle.
Chris Appleton, how far do you think China will take their territorial dispute with Japan?
It's hard to say. I think this is an issue that depends very much on what happens domestically within China, within the new leadership. There are very different voices on this, as indeed there are different voices on almost everything now. I mean, think about North Korea. They're so badly split on North Korea that they, you know, haven't been, maybe up to quite recently, able to do anything in terms of changing their overall approach. My biggest fear in the relationship between China and Japan is that some kind of accident should happen, probably at sea, that would throw this into a situation which it would be very hard for either country to step back from. There's one advisor in particular who works fairly closely with the new president and head of the party, who for a long time has been pushing the idea that China needs a very fundamental rethink of its overall relationship with Japan. He's very much been a lone voice on these kinds of things, but a very outspoken one, and one with a perfect party pedigree, so he can say whatever he wants to say. And his point is, of course, a very sensible one. China cannot rise as the predominant power in Asia against Japan. It can only rise with Japan. I mean, as long as Japan continues to be there as an unsinkable American aircraft carrier right off the Asian mainland, China has absolutely no possibility of even becoming the predominant power within its own region. That's the point that he's been putting. And it's a very strong, very forceful argument. But it comes up against the dyed-in-the-wool nationalism that is there, and particularly, of course, as we all know, for historical reasons with regard to Japan. So I'm a reasonable optimist with regard to this. And I think over time, unless an accident happens, I think this will revert, probably not to any kind of very positive relationship, but at least to the way it was before both sides started emphasizing the Yaoi Senkaku conflict.
Over here, Jane, sorry, I said I was going right here, then we'll come to Jane, please.
Hi, I'm Jane Singer from Inside Fashion. Getting back to your comment on demographics and the fact that China will likely grow old before it grows rich as a result of not having enough young people coming on, and that even if they were to change that now, it wouldn't be enough. Do you foresee, I don't know that they would implement it, but would you feel that immigration might be an opportunity to solve that in some way? In other words, trying to attract some of the young people from elsewhere in the region?
It's certainly something that they are thinking about. Given what I've said about China's soft power so far, meaning its attractiveness, it's very hard to see that. Last time I brought this up, this was during my November visit in Beijing with some pretty high-ranking party officials, and including, of course, the gender imbalance, which is a very important part of this question. You know, they said, you know, this won't be a problem. We will solve it through immigration. I mean, and I said, immigration? I mean, China doesn't really have much of a tradition of immigration. They said, no problem. You know, there are so many young ladies around in East Asia who would like to come in and marry wealthy young Chinese gentlemen, you know, that this would. It shows, I think, you know, the inability to get to grips with the hardcore essence of some of these problems that you find within the party. I mean, these were not unreasonable men on other issues, but completely living in a dream world when it comes to what China can do to make up for the self-inflicted difficulties with regard to demographics. So I think the answer to your question from my perspective is no. I do not think it is very likely that, I mean, that it's likelier in China than what it were in Japan, for instance, or quite a number of other countries, that a sensible immigration policy could make up for the difficulties in terms of demographics that we see developing now.
Over here.
Adi Desai from Lehman Advisors. Professor, could you explain the role of investment decisions, foreign investment decisions by state-owned companies? And
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
The foreign investment decisions by state-owned companies of China and how they play into these the entire international relations framework. I mean, to give you examples, like the significant investments made in ports in Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Myanmar, Africa, in Eastern Africa especially, Kazakhstan, etc. And how does this, or is this like a wider sort of strategic decision, or is it, are these just individual investment decisions being made by independent companies?
I think the best answer to that is that it is probably a mix. I mean, that's the cheap answer as well, of course. But I think my emphasis would be on the side saying that in most cases, these are business decisions more than strategic decisions. And that has a little bit to do with my knowledge of how these one of the big Chinese state companies operate. I'm sure many of you will know that as well. Increasingly, they behave like private companies. There was one case not long ago, a friend of mine who heads up a rather big Chinese state-owned company, who was asked by the relevant small leading group to do something, which he was very reluctant to do. So he met with them, and you know, they said, we would like you to do this. And he said, that's fine. Of course, do anything from our country. And you are the owners, so of course I want to do everything with the owners. But I also have to look after my bottom line. I mean, that's why I was put in place. And if you can guarantee that the business losses that we may incur by making this particular investment will be covered by the government, then of course I'm willing to do it, which of course they weren't. So, I mean, there are, it's far too easy to say that all of these are strategic investments that are done for, you know, for military, or with a military implication of some sort. There are exceptions. I think the Pakistani port, Gwadar, is it? At least they had to have an acceptance fairly high up of doing that. That story went back and forth for quite a long time because the company that's behind it wanted to do it and they were actually licensed to do it. Then this thing about the ports in Burma came up, where the Navy was involved through one of their companies, overreached massively. Hu Jintao, who wasn't given to these kinds of things normally, really had a fit. I mean, people demoted over this within the at the top ranks of the Chinese Navy for doing things that were not in their place to do. And the first round of that investment drowned in that process. Now they are back at doing it, and I don't know why they're back at doing it and what decisions have been made in that particular case. So it is a mix, but don't exaggerated. I mean, don't think that China is capable of making all of these decisions strategically. They aren't.
We have time for one more question, which I'm happy to put forward if you want. Your book is about a restless empire and a very centralized government, essentially. But one thing that's been fascinating to hear you talk about is a lot of the conversations you've had and tidbits that you've seen over the last few years. Do you sense that things are changing, that there will be an increase in sort of flexibility as to how China views its foreign policy and its role in the world? A generational change has just taken power.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that, I mean, the general trend has been towards more flexibility. I mean, again, as all of you here will know, flexibility comes out of knowledge. The more you know, the less fearful you are, and then you think, at least, sometimes incorrectly, but you do think that you can make wise decisions, and that you can make wise decisions on a whole scale of different policy outcomes. If you know very little about the world, you are much narrower in terms of the decisions that you can make. So I think with that increased knowledge, and so are the people in the new generation who are advisors, not so much decision makers, but advisors on foreign affairs, are infinitely much better than what the last generation would be. I mean, they're trained at some of the world's best universities. Won't mention any here, but they're trained at some very, very good schools abroad. The strange situation that you have with regard to China still, that people who've been to Harvard or LSE or Oxford or whatever cannot become Chinese diplomats. I mean, they're still barred from doing that. With special dispensation, you can now do it, and I think this ridiculous rule will soon be abolished. It's something they inherited from the Soviets back in the old days. If you've been abroad, you're sort of very suspicious. But of course, these people with a keen, almost organic interest in international affairs can serve as key advisors to the party apparatus. And I actually think that part of the reason why that's where you have to look for dynamism now in terms of China's foreign affairs have to do with this rather simple, straightforward personnel issue. That's where you find the brains. You know, you find them as staffers for the international department, for the small leading group on foreign affairs, and especially perhaps at the Central Party School. I mean, that's where you find the thinkers. And these people are influential. The foreign ministry is far down the list of those who actually deliver strategic advice to the top leadership. So in that sense, I'm an optimist. My biggest fear with regard to China and with regard to the region are things that cannot easily be controlled. I mean, a meltdown in North Korea, which will happen at some point, because this regime will not survive, cannot survive. You know, that's the kind of thing that puts everything on the table. And then these people within the Chinese foreign policy leadership will have to face up to the truth that they will actually have to present their arguments in semi-public, something that they're not very comfortable with, in order to win that crucial debate of what China should then do. So it's a very fluid kind of situation. But in terms of dynamism, in terms of flexibility, certainly there has been improvement. Now, as we know, you know, flexibility and dynamism doesn't always convert into positive values when it comes to decision making.
A lot of food for thought and interesting ideas. Thank you very much for joining us today. A small gift from the FCC for coming to join us, and we hope to see you more often and downstairs for drinks in the bar as well. And Professor Westad will be here to sign books after this lunch. Thanks very much, everyone.